Spring in Fialta. Spring in Fialta is cloudy and dull. Everything is damp. The piebald trunks of the plane trees and the juniper shrubs, the railings, the gravel. Far away in a watery vista between the jagged edges of pale bluish houses which have tottered up from their knees to climb the slope, a cypress indicating the way, the blurred Mount St. George is more than ever remote from its likeness on the picture postcards which, since 1910, say, those straw hats, those youthful cabmen, have been courting the tourist from the sorry-go-round of their prop, among amethyst-toothed lumps of rock and the mantelpiece dreams of seashells. The air is windless and warm, with a faint tang of burning. The sea, its salt drowned in a solution of rain, is less glaucous than gray, with waves too sluggish to break into foam. It was on such a day in the early 30s that I found myself, all my senses wide open, on one of Fialta's steep little streets, taking in everything at once, that marine rococo on the stand, and the coral crucifixes in a shop window, and the dejected poster of a visiting circus, one corner of its drenched paper detached from the wall, and a yellow bit of unripe orange peel on the old slate-blue sidewalk, which retained here and there a fading memory of ancient mosaic design. I am fond of Fialta. I am fond of it because I feel in the hollow of those violaceous syllables the sweet, dark dampness of the most rumpled of small flowers, and because the alto-like name of a lovely Crimean town is echoed by its viola, and also because there is something in the very somnolence of its humid length that especially anoints one's soul. So I was happy to be there again, to trudge uphill in inverse direction to the rivulet of the gutter, hatless, my head wet, my skin already suffused with warmth, although I wore only a light mackintosh over my shirt. I had come on the Caparabella Express, which, with that reckless gusto peculiar to trains in mountainous country, had done its thundering best to collect throughout the night as many tunnels as possible. A day or two, just as long as a breathing spell in the midst of a business trip would allow me, was all I expected to stay. I had left my wife and children at home, and that was an island of happiness always present in the clear north of my being, always floating beside me, and even through me, I dare say, but yet keeping on the outside of me most of the time. A pantless infant of the male sex with a taut, mud-gray little belly jerkily stepped down from a doorstep and waddled off, bow-legged, trying to carry three oranges at once, but continuously dropping the variable third, until he fell himself, and then a girl of 12 or so, with a string of heavy beads around her dusky neck, and wearing a skirt as long as that of a gypsy, promptly took away the whole lot with her more nimble and more numerous hands. Nearby, on the wet terrace of a café, a waiter was wiping the slabs of tables, a melancholy brigand hawking local lollipops, elaborate-looking things with a lunar gloss, had placed a hopelessly full basket on the cracked balustrade over which the two were conversing. Either the drizzle had stopped or Fialta had got so used to it that she herself did not know whether she was breathing moist air or warm rain. Thumb filling his pipe from a rubber pouch as he walked, a plus-Ford Englishman of the solid exportable sort came from under an arch and entered a pharmacy, where large pale sponges in a blue vase were dying a thirsty death behind their glass. What luscious elation I felt rippling through my veins! How gratefully my whole being responded to the flutters and effluvia of that gray day saturated with a vernal essence which itself it seemed slow in perceiving. My nerves were unusually receptive after a sleepless night. I assimilated everything. The whistling of a thrush in the almond trees beyond the chapel, the peace of the crumbling houses, the pulse of the distant sea, panting in the mist, all this together with the jealous green of bottle glass bristling along the top of a wall, and the fast colors of a circus advertisement featuring a feathered Indian on a rearing horse in the act of lassoing a boldly endemic zebra, while some thoroughly fooled elephants sat brooding upon their star-spangled thrones. Presently the same Englishman overtook me, As I absorbed him along with the rest, I happened to notice the sudden side roll of his big blue eye, straining at its crimson canthus, and the way he rapidly moistened his lips, because of the dryness of those sponges, I thought, but then I followed the direction of his glance and saw Nina. Every time I had met her during the 15 years of our, well, I failed to find the precise term for our kind of relationship, she had not seemed to recognize me at once, and this time, too, she remained quite still for a moment on the opposite sidewalk, half turning toward me in sympathetic incertitude, mixed with curiosity. Only her yellow scarf already on the move like those dogs that recognize you before their owners do. And then she uttered a cry, her hands up, all her 10 fingers dancing, and in the middle of the street, with merely the frank impulsiveness of an old friendship, just as she would rapidly make the sign of the cross over me every time we parted, she kissed me thrice, with more mouth than meaning, and then walked beside me, hanging on to me, adjusting her stride to mine, hampered by her narrow brown skirt perfunctorily slit down the side. "Oh, yes, Ferdy is here too," she replied, and immediately, in her turn, inquired nicely after Elena. "Must be loafing somewhere around with Segur," she went on in reference to her husband, "and I have some shopping to do. We leave after lunch. Wait a moment. Where are you leading me, Victor dear?" Back into the past. Back into the past, as I did every time I met her, repeating the whole accumulation of the plot from the very beginning up to the last increment. Thus, in Russian fairy tales, the already told is bunched up again at every new turn of the story. This time we had met in warm and misty Fialta, and I could not have celebrated the occasion with greater art, could not have adorned with brighter vignettes the list of fate's former services, even if I had known that this was to be the last one. The last one, I maintain, for I cannot imagine any heavenly firm of brokers that might consent to arrange me a meeting with her beyond the grave. My introductory scene with Nina had been laid in Russia quite a long time ago, around 1917, I should say, judging by certain left-wing theater rumblings backstage. It was at some birthday party at my aunt's on her country estate near Luga, in the deepest folds of winter. How well I remember the first sign of nearing the place, a red barn in a white wilderness. I had just graduated from the Imperial Lyceum. Nina was already engaged. Although she was of my age and of that of the century, she looked 20 at least. And this in spite, or perhaps because of her neat, slender build, whereas at 32 that very slightness of hers made her look younger. Her fiancé was a guardsman on leave from the front, a handsome, heavy fellow, incredibly well-bred and stolid, who weighed every word on the scales of the most exact common sense, and spoke in a velvety baritone, which grew even smoother when he addressed her. His decency and devotion probably got on her nerves, and he is now a successful, if somewhat lonesome, engineer in a most distant tropical country. Windows light up and stretch their luminous lengths upon the dark, billowy snow, making room for the reflection of the fan-shaped light above the front door between them. Each of the 2 side pillars is fluffily fringed with white, which rather spoils the lines of what might have been a perfect ex libris for the book of our 2 lives. I cannot recall why we had all wandered out of the sonorous hall into the still darkness, peopled only with firs, snow-swollen to twice their size. Did the watchman invite us to look at a sullen red glow in the sky, portent of nearing arson? Possibly. Did we go to admire an equestrian statue of ice sculptured near the pond by the Swiss tutor of my cousins? Quite as likely. My memory revives only on the way back to the brightly symmetrical mansion toward which we tramped in single file along a narrow furrow between snowbanks, with that crunch, 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 which is the only comment that a taciturn winter night makes upon humans. I walked last. 3 singing steps ahead of me walked a small, bent shape. The firs gravely showed their burdened paws. I slipped and dropped the dead flashlight someone had forced upon me, It was devilishly hard to retrieve, and instantly attracted by my curses with an eager, low laugh in anticipation of fun, Nina dimly veered toward me. I called her Nina, but I could hardly have known her name yet. Hardly could we have had time, she and I, for any preliminary. "Who's that?" she asked with interest, and I was already kissing her neck, smooth and quite fiery hot from the long fox fur of her coat collar, which kept getting into my way until she clasped my shoulder, and with the candor so peculiar to her gently fitted her generous, dutiful lips to mine. But suddenly, parting us by its explosion of gaiety, the theme of a snowball fight started in the dark, and someone, fleeing, falling, crunching, laughing, and panting, climbed adrift, tried to run, and uttered a horrible groan. Deep snow had performed the amputation of an arctic, and soon after we all dispersed to our respective homes, without my having talked with Nina, nor made any plans about the future, about those 15 itinerant years that had already set out toward the dim horizon, loaded with the parts of our unassembled meetings. And as I watched her in the maze of gestures and shadows of gestures, of which the rest of that evening consisted, probably parlor games, with Nina persistently in the other camp, I was astonished, I remember, not so much by her inattention to me after that warmth in the snow, as by the innocent naturalness of that inattention. For I did not yet know that, had I said a word, it would have changed at once into a wonderful sunburst of kindness, a cheerful, compassionate attitude with all possible cooperation, as if woman's love were spring water, containing salubrious salts, which at the least notice she ever so willingly gave anyone to drink. "Let me see. Where did we last meet?" I began, addressing the Fialta version of Nina, in order to bring to her small face with prominent cheekbones and dark red lips a certain expression I knew. And sure enough, the shake of her head and the puckered brow seemed less to imply forgetfulness than to deplore the flatness of an old joke. Or to be more exact, it was as if all those cities where fate had fixed our various rendezvous, without ever attending them personally, all those platforms and stairs and three-walled rooms and dark back alleys were trite settings remaining after some other lives all brought to a close long before, and were so little related to the acting out of our own aimless destiny that it was almost bad taste to mention them. I accompanied her into a shop under the arcades. There, in the twilight, beyond a beaded curtain, she fingered some red leather purses stuffed with tissue paper, peering at the price tags as if wishing to learn their museum names. She wanted, she said, exactly that shape but in fawn. And when, after 10 minutes of frantic rustling, the old Dalmatian found such a freak by a miracle that has puzzled me ever since, Nina, who was about to pick some money out of my hand, changed her mind and went through the streaming beads without having bought anything. Outside, it was just as milky dull as before, the same smell of burning, stirring my Tartar memories, drifted from the bare windows of the pale houses. A small swarm of gnats was busy darning the air above Mimosa, which bloomed listlessly, her sleeves trailing to the very ground. Two workmen in broad-brimmed hats were lunching on cheese and garlic, their backs against a circus billboard, which depicted a red hussar and an orange tiger of sorts. Curious in his effort to make the beast as ferocious as possible, the artist had gone so far that he had to come back from the other side, for the tiger's face looked positively human. "Au fond, I wanted a comb," said Nina with belated regret. How familiar to me were her hesitations, second thoughts, third thoughts, mirroring first ones, ephemeral worries between trains. She had always either just arrived or was about to leave. And of this I find it hard to think without feeling humiliated by the variety of intricate routes one feverishly follows in order to keep that final appointment, which the most confirmed dawdler knows to be unavoidable. Had I to submit before judges of our earthly existence a specimen of her average pose, I would have perhaps placed her leaning upon a counter at Cook's, left calf crossing right shin, left toe tapping floor, sharp elbows and coin spilling bag on the counter, while the employee, pencil in hand, pondered with her over the plan of an eternal sleeping car. After the exodus from Russia, I saw her, and that was the second time, in Berlin, at the house of some friends. I was about to get married. She had just broken with her fiancé. As I entered that room, I caught sight of her at once, and having glanced at the other guests, I instinctively determined which of the men knew more about her than I. She was sitting in the corner of a couch, her feet pulled up, her small, comfortable body folded in the form of a Z. An ashtray stood aslant on the couch near one of her heels, and having squinted at me and listened to my name, she removed her stalk-like cigarette holder from her lips and proceeded to utter slowly and joyfully, "Well, of all people!" And at once it became clear to everyone, beginning with her, that we had long been on intimate terms. Unquestionably, she had forgotten all about the actual kiss, but somehow, because of that trivial occurrence, she found herself recollecting a vague sketch of warm, pleasant friendship, which in reality had never existed between us. Thus the whole cast of our relationship was fraudulently based upon an imaginary amity, which had nothing to do with her random goodwill. Our meeting proved quite insignificant in regard to the words we said, but already no barriers divided us. And when that night I happened to be seated beside her at supper, I shamelessly tested the extent of her secret patience. Then she vanished again, and a year later my wife and I were seeing my brother off to Posen, and when the train had gone and we were moving toward the exit along the other side of the platform, suddenly near a car of the Paris Express, I saw Nina, her face buried in the bouquet she held, in the midst of a group of people whom she had befriended without my knowledge, and who stood in a circle gaping at her, as idlers gape at a street row, a lost child, or the victim of an accident. Brightly, she signaled to me with her flowers. I introduced her to Elena, and in that life-quickening atmosphere of a big railway station where everything is something trembling on the brink of something else, thus to be clutched and cherished, the exchange of a few words was enough to enable two totally dissimilar women to start calling each other by their pet names the very next time they met. That day, in the blue shade of the Paris car, Ferdinand was first mentioned. I learned with a ridiculous pang that she was about to marry him. Doors were beginning to slam. She quickly but piously kissed her friends, climbed into the vestibule, disappeared, and then I saw her through the glass settling herself in her compartment, having suddenly forgotten about us or passed into another world, and we all, our hands in our pockets, seemed to be spying upon an utterly unsuspecting life moving in that aquarium dimness, until she grew aware of us and drummed on the window pane, then raised her eyes, fumbling at the frame as if hanging a picture. But nothing happened. Some fellow passenger helped her, and she leaned out, audible and real, beaming with pleasure. One of us, keeping up with the stealthily gliding car, handed her a magazine and a Tauchnitz. She read English only when traveling. All was slipping away with beautiful smoothness, and I held a platform ticket crumpled beyond recognition, while a song of the last century, connected, it has been rumored, with some Parisian drama of love, kept ringing and ringing in my head, having emerged, God knows why, from the music box of memory, a sobbing ballad which often used to be sung by an old maiden aunt of mine, with a face as yellow as Russian church wax, but whom nature had given such a powerful, ecstatically full voice that it seemed to swallow her up in the glory of a fiery cloud, as soon as she would begin, "On dit que tu t'es marié, tu sais que j'en vais mourir." And that melody, the pain, the offense, the link between hymen and death, evoked by the rhythm, and the voice itself of the dead singer, which accompanied the recollection as the sole owner of the song, gave me no rest for several hours after Nina's departure, and even later arose at increasing intervals like the last flat little waves sent to the beach by a passing ship, lapping ever more infrequently and dreamily, or like the bronze agony of a vibrating belfry after the bell ringer has already reseated himself in the cheerful circle of his family. And another year or two later, I was in Paris on business, and one morning, on the landing of a hotel, where I had been looking up a film actor fellow, there she was again, clad in a gray tailored suit, waiting for the elevator to take her down, a key dangling from her fingers. "Ferdinand has gone fencing," she said conversationally. Her eyes rested on the lower part of my face as if she were lip-reading, and after a moment of reflection, her amatory comprehension was matchless, she turned and rapidly swaying on slender ankles led me along the sea-blue carpeted passage. A chair at the door of her room supported a tray with the remains of breakfast, a honey-stained knife, crumbs on the gray porcelain. But the room had already been done, and because of our sudden draft a wave of muslin, embroidered with white dahlias, got sucked in with a shudder and knock between the responsive halves of the French window, and only when the door had been locked did they let go that curtain with something like a blissful sigh. And a little later I stepped out on the diminutive cast-iron balcony beyond to inhale the combined smell of dry maple leaves and gasoline, the dregs of the hazy blue morning street, and as I did not yet realize the presence of that growing morbid pathos which was to embitter so my subsequent meetings with Nina, I was probably quite as collected and carefree as she was, when from the hotel I accompanied her to some office or other to trace a suitcase she had lost, and thence to the café where her husband was holding session with his court of the moment. I will not mention the name, and what bits of it I happen to give here appear in decorous disguise, of that man, that Franco-Hungarian writer. I would rather not dwell upon him at all, but I cannot help it. He is surging up from under my pen. Today one does not hear much about him, and this is good, for it proves that I was right in resisting his evil spell, right in experiencing a creepy chill down my spine whenever this or that new book of his touched my hand. The fame of his likes circulates briskly but soon grows heavy and stale, and as for history it will limit his life story to the dash between two dates. Lean and arrogant, with some poisonous pun ever ready to fork out and quiver at you, and with a strange look of expectancy in his dull brown veiled eyes, this false wag had, I dare say, an irresistible effect on small rodents. Having mastered the art of verbal invention to perfection, he particularly prided himself on being a weaver of words, a title he valued higher than that of a writer. Personally, I never could understand what was the good of thinking up books, of penning things that had not really happened in some way or other, and I remember once saying to him, as I braved the mockery of his encouraging nods, that, were I a writer, I should allow only my heart to have imagination, and for the rest rely upon memory, that long-drawn sunset shadow of one's personal truth. I had known his books before I knew him. A faint disgust was already replacing the aesthetic pleasure which I had suffered his first novel to give me. At the beginning of his career it had been possible, perhaps, to distinguish some human landscape, some old garden, some dream-familiar disposition of trees through the stained glass of his prodigious prose. But with every new book the tints grew still more dense, the gules and purpure still more ominous, and today one can no longer see anything at all through that blazoned, ghastly, rich glass. And it seems that were one to break it, nothing but a perfectly black void would face one's shivering soul. But how dangerous he was in his prime! What venom he squirted! With what whips he lashed when provoked! The tornado of his passing satire left a barren waste where felled oaks lay in a row, and the dust still twisted, and the unfortunate author of some adverse review, howling with pain, spun like a top in the dust. At the time we met, his Passage à Niveau was being acclaimed in Paris. He was, as they say, surrounded, and Nina, whose adaptability was an amazing substitute for the culture she lacked, had already assumed, if not the part of a muse, at least that of a soulmate, and subtle advisor, following Ferdinand's creative convolutions and loyally sharing his artistic tastes. For although it is wildly improbable that she had ever waded through a single volume of his, she had a magic knack of gleaning all the best passages from the shop talk of literary friends. An orchestra of women was playing when we entered the café. First I noted the ostrich thigh of a harp reflected in one of the mirror-faced pillars, and then I saw the composite table, small ones drawn together to form a long one, at which, with his back to the plush wall, Ferdinand was presiding. And for a moment his whole attitude, the position of his parted hands, and the faces of his table companions all turned toward him, reminded me in a grotesque, nightmarish way of something I did not quite grasp, but when I did so in retrospect, the suggested comparison struck me as hardly less sacrilegious than the nature of his art itself. He wore a white turtleneck sweater under a tweed coat. His glossy hair was combed back from the temples, and above it cigarette smoke hung like a halo. His bony, pharaoh-like face was motionless. His eyes alone roved this way and that, full of dim satisfaction. Having forsaken the two or three obvious haunts where naive amateurs of Montparnassian life would have expected to find him, he had started patronizing this perfectly bourgeois establishment because of his peculiar sense of humor, which made him derive ghoulish fun from the pitiful spécialité de la maison. This orchestra, composed of half a dozen weary-looking, self-conscious ladies interlacing mild harmonies on a crammed platform, and not knowing, as he put it, what to do with their motherly bosoms, quite superfluous in the world of music. After each number he would be convulsed by a fit of epileptic applause, which the ladies had stopped acknowledging, and which was already arousing, I thought, certain doubts in the minds of the proprietor of the café and its fundamental customers, but which seemed highly diverting to Ferdinand's friends. Among these, I recall, an artist with an impeccably bald though slightly chipped head, which under various pretexts he constantly painted into his eye and guitar canvases, a poet whose special gag was the ability to represent, if you asked him, Adam's Fall by means of five matches, a humble businessman who financed surrealist ventures and paid for the aperitifs, if permitted to print in a corner eulogistic allusions to the actress he kept, a pianist, presentable insofar as the face was concerned, but with a dreadful expression of the fingers, a jaunty but linguistically impotent Soviet writer, fresh from Moscow, with an old pipe and a new wristwatch, who was completely and ridiculously unaware of the sort of company he was in. There were several other gentlemen present who have become confused in my memory, and doubtless two or three of the lot had been intimate with Nina. She was the only woman at the table. There she stooped, eagerly sucking at a straw, the level of her lemonade sinking with a kind of childish celerity. And only when the last drop had gurgled and squeaked, and she had pushed away the straw with her tongue, only then did I finally catch her eye, which I had been obstinately seeking, still not being able to cope with the fact that she had had time to forget what had occurred earlier in the morning, to forget it so thoroughly that upon meeting my glance she replied with a blank, questioning smile. And only after peering more closely did she remember suddenly what kind of answering smile I was expecting. Meanwhile, Ferdinand, the ladies having temporarily left the platform after pushing away their instruments like so many pieces of furniture, was juicily drawing his cronies' attention to the figure of an elderly luncher in a far corner of the café, who had, as some Frenchmen for some reason or other have, a little red ribbon or something on his coat lapel, and whose gray beard combined with his mustaches to form a cozy yellowish nest for his sloppily munching mouth. Somehow the trappings of old age always amused Ferdy. I did not stay long in Paris, but that week proved sufficient to engender between him and me that fake chumminess, the imposing of which he had such a talent for. Subsequently, I even turned out to be of some use to him. My firm acquired the film rights of one of his more intelligible stories, and then he had a good time pestering me with telegrams. As the years passed, we found ourselves every now and then beaming at each other in some place, but I never felt at ease in his presence. And that day in Fialta, too, I experienced a familiar depression upon learning that he was on the prowl nearby. One thing, however, considerably cheered me up: the flop of his recent play. And here he was, coming toward us, garbed in an absolutely waterproof coat with belt and pocket flaps, a camera across his shoulder, double rubber soles to his shoes, sucking with an imperturbability that was meant to be funny a long stick of moonstone candy, that specialty of Fialta's. Beside him walked the dapper, doll-like Rosie Segur, a lover of art and a perfect fool. I never could discover for what purpose Ferdinand needed him, and I still hear Nina exclaiming with a moaning tenderness that did not commit her to anything, "Oh, he is such a darling, Segur!" They approached. Ferdinand and I greeted each other lustily, trying to crowd into handshake and backslap as much fervor as possible, knowing by experience that actually that was all but pretending it was only a preface. And it always happened like that. After every separation, we met to the accompaniment of strings being excitedly tuned, in a bustle of geniality, in the hubbub of sentiments taking their seats. But the ushers would close the doors, and after that no one was admitted. Segur complained to me about the weather, and at first I did not understand what he was talking about. Even if the moist, gray, greenhouse essence of Fialta might be called weather, it was just as much outside of anything that could serve us as a topic of conversation as was, for instance, Nina's slender elbow, which I was holding between finger and thumb, or a bit of tinfoil someone had dropped, shining in the middle of the cobbled street in the distance. We four moved on, big purchases still looming ahead. "God, what an Indian!" Ferdinand suddenly exclaimed with fierce relish, violently nudging me and pointing at a poster. Farther on, near a fountain, he gave his stick of candy to a native child, a swarthy girl with beads round her pretty neck. We stopped to wait for him. He crouched, saying something to her, addressing her sooty black lowered eyelashes, and then he caught up with us, grinning and making one of those remarks with which he loved to spice his speech. Then his attention was drawn by an unfortunate object exhibited in a souvenir shop, a dreadful marble imitation of Mount St. George, showing a black tunnel at its base, which turned out to be the mouth of an inkwell, and with a compartment for pens in the semblance of railroad tracks. Open-mouthed, quivering, all agog with sardonic triumph, he turned that dusty, cumbersome, and perfectly irresponsible thing in his hands, paid without bargaining, and with his mouth still open came out carrying the monster. Like some autocrat who surrounds himself with hunchbacks and dwarfs, he would become attached to this or that hideous object. This infatuation might last from 5 minutes to several days, or even longer if the thing happened to be animate. Nina wistfully alluded to lunch, and seizing the opportunity when Ferdinand and Segur stopped at a post office, I hastened to lead her away. I still wonder what exactly she meant to me, that small dark woman of the narrow shoulders and lyrical limbs, to quote the expression of a mincing emigre poet, one of the few men who had sighed platonically after her. And still less do I understand what was the purpose of fate in bringing us constantly together. I did not see her for quite a long while after my sojourn in Paris, and then one day, when I came home from my office, I found her having tea with my wife and examining on her silk-hosed hand, with her wedding ring gleaming through, the texture of some stockings bought cheap in Tauentzienstrasse. Once I was shown her photograph in a fashion magazine full of autumn leaves and gloves and windswept golf links. On a certain Christmas, she sent me a picture postcard with snow and stars. On a Riviera beach, she almost escaped my notice behind her dark glasses and terracotta tan. Another day, having dropped in on an ill-timed errand at the house of some strangers where a party was in progress, I saw her scarf and fur coat among alien scarecrows on a coat rack. In a bookshop, she nodded to me from a page of one of her husband's stories, a page referring to an episodic servant girl but smuggling in Nina in spite of the author's intention. Her face, he wrote, was rather nature's snapshot than a meticulous portrait, so that when tried to imagine it, all he could visualize were fleeting glimpses of disconnected features, the downy outline of her pommettes in the sun, the amber-tinted brown darkness of quick eyes, lips shaped into a friendly smile, which was always ready to change into an ardent kiss. Again and again she hurriedly appeared in the margins of my life, without influencing in the least its basic text. One summer morning, Friday, because housemaids were thumping out carpets in the sun-dusted yard, my family was away in the country, and I was lolling and smoking in bed, when I heard the bell ring with tremendous violence, and there she was in the hall, having burst in to leave, incidentally, a hairpin, and mainly, a trunk illuminated with hotel labels, which a fortnight later was retrieved for her by a nice Austrian boy, who, according to intangible but sure symptoms, belonged to the same very cosmopolitan association of which I was a member. Occasionally, in the middle of a conversation, her name would be mentioned, and she would run down the steps of a chance sentence without turning her head. While traveling in the Pyrenees, I spent a week at the chateau belonging to people with whom she and Ferdinand happened to be staying, and I shall never forget my first night there, how I waited, how certain I was that without my having to tell her she would steal to my room, how she did not come, and the din thousands of crickets made in the delirious depth of the rocky garden dripping with moonlight, the mad bubbling brooks, and my struggle between blissful southern fatigue after a long day of hunting on the screes, and the wild thirst for her stealthy coming, low laugh, pink ankles above the swan's down trimming of high-heeled slippers. But the night raved on, and she did not come. And when next day, in the course of a general ramble in the mountains, I told her of my waiting, she clasped her hands in dismay, and at once, with a rapid glance, estimated whether the backs of the gesticulating Ferd and his friend had sufficiently receded. I remember talking to her on the telephone across half of Europe, on her husband's business, and not recognizing at first her eager barking voice, and I remember once dreaming of her. I dreamt that my eldest girl had run in to tell me the doorman was sorely in trouble, and when I had gone down to him, I saw lying on a trunk a roll of burlap under her head, pale-lipped and wrapped in a woolen kerchief, Nina fast asleep, as miserable refugees sleep in godforsaken railway stations. And regardless of what happened to me or to her in between, we never discussed anything, as we never thought of each other during the intervals in our destiny, so that when we met, the pace of life altered at once, all its atoms were recombined, and we lived in another, lighter time medium, which was measured not by the lengthy separations, but by those few meetings of which a short, supposedly frivolous life was thus artificially formed. And with each new meeting I grew more and more apprehensive. No, I did not experience any inner emotional collapse. The shadow of tragedy did not haunt our revels. My married life remained unimpaired, while on the other hand, her eclectic husband ignored her casual affairs, although deriving some profit from them in the way of pleasant and useful connections. I grew apprehensive because something lovely, delicate, and unrepeatable was being wasted, something which I abused by snapping off poor bright bits in gross haste while neglecting the modest but true core which perhaps it kept offering me in a pitiful whisper. I was apprehensive because, in the long run, I was somehow accepting Nina's life, the lies, the futility, the gibberish of that life. Even in the absence of any sentimental discord, I felt myself bound to seek for a rational, if not moral, interpretation of my existence, and this meant choosing between the world in which I sat for my portrait, with my wife, my young daughters, the Doberman Pinscher, idyllic garlands, a signet ring, a slender cane, between that happy, wise, and good world, and what? Was there any practical chance of life together with Nina? Life I could barely imagine, for it would be penetrated, I knew, with a passionate, intolerable bitterness, and every moment of it would be aware of a past, teeming with protean partners. No, the thing was absurd. And moreover, was she not chained to her husband by something stronger than love? The staunch friendship between two convicts? Absurd. But then, what should I have done with you, Nina? How should I have disposed of the store of sadness that had gradually accumulated as a result of our seemingly carefree but really hopeless meetings? Fialta consists of the old town and of the new one. Here and there, past and present are interlaced, struggling either to disentangle themselves or to thrust each other out. Each one has its own methods. The newcomer fights honestly, importing palm trees, setting up smart tourist agencies, painting with creamy lines the red smoothness of tennis courts, whereas the sneaky old-timer creeps out from behind a corner in the shape of some little street on crutches or the steps of stairs leading nowhere. On our way to the hotel, we pass the half-built white villa full of litter within, on a wall of which, again the same elephants, their monstrous baby knees wide apart, sat on huge, gaudy drums. In ethereal bundles, the equestrian, already with a penciled mustache, was resting on a broad-backed steed, and the tomato-nosed clown was walking a tightrope, balancing an umbrella, ornamented with those recurrent stars, a vague symbolic recollection of the heavenly fatherland of circus performers. Here in the Riviera part of Fialta, the wet gravel crunched in a more luxurious manner, and the lazy sighing of the sea was more audible. In the backyard of the hotel, a kitchen boy armed with a knife was pursuing a hen which was clucking madly as it raced for its life. A bootblack offered me his ancient throne with a toothless smile. Under the plane trees stood a motorcycle of German make, a mud-bespattered limousine, and a yellow, long-bodied Icarus that looked like a giant scarab. "That's ours. Segur's, I mean," said Nina, adding, "Why don't you come with us, Victor?" Although she knew very well that I could not come. In the lacquer of its elytra, a gouache of sky and branches was engulfed. In the metal of one of the bomb-shaped lamps we ourselves were momentarily reflected, lean filmland pedestrians passing along the convex surface. And then, after a few steps, I glanced back and foresaw, in an almost optical sense, as it were, what really happened an hour or so later. The three of them, wearing motoring helmets, getting in, smiling and waving to me, transparent to me like ghosts, with the color of the world shining through them. And then they were moving, receding, diminishing. Nina's last ten-fingered farewell. But actually the automobile was still standing quite motionless, smooth and whole like an egg. And Nina, under my outstretched arm, was entering a laurel-flanked doorway. And as we sat down, we could see through the window Ferdinand and Segur, who had come by another way, slowly approaching. There was no one on the veranda where we lunched except the Englishman I had recently observed. In front of him, a long glass containing a bright crimson drink threw an oval reflection on the tablecloth. In his eyes I noticed the same bloodshot desire, but now it was in no sense related to Nina. That avid look was not directed at her at all, but was fixed on the upper right-hand corner of the broad window near which he was sitting. Having pulled the gloves off her small, thin hands, Nina, for the last time in her life, was eating the shellfish of which she was so fond. Ferdinand also busied himself with food, and I took advantage of his hunger to begin a conversation which gave me the semblance of power over him. To be specific, I mentioned his recent failure. After a brief period of fashionable religious conversion, during which grace descended upon him and he undertook some rather ambiguous pilgrimages, which ended in a decidedly scandalous adventure, he had turned his dull eyes toward barbarous Moscow. Now, frankly speaking, I have always been irritated by the complacent conviction that a ripple of stream consciousness, a few healthy obscenities and a dash of communism in any old slop pail will alchemically and automatically produce ultra-modern literature. And I will contend until I am shot that art, as soon as it is brought into contact with politics, inevitably sinks to the level of any ideological trash. In Ferdinand's case, it is true, all this was rather irrelevant. The muscles of his muse were exceptionally strong, to say nothing of the fact that he didn't care a damn for the plight of the underdog. But because of certain obscurely mischievous undercurrents of that sort, his art had become still more repulsive. Except for a few snobs, none had understood the play. I had not seen it myself, but could well imagine that elaborate Kremlin-esque night along the impossible spirals of which he spun various wheels of dismembered symbols. And now, not without pleasure, I asked him whether he had read a recent bit of criticism about himself.
"Criticism!" he exclaimed. "Fine criticism! Every slick jackanapes sees fit to read me a lecture. Ignorance of my work is their bliss. My books are touched gingerly as one touches something that may go bang. Criticism! They are examined from every point of view except the essential one. It is as if a naturalist, in describing the equine genus, started to jaw about saddles or Madame de V." He named a well-known literary hostess who, indeed, strongly resembled a grinning horse. "I would like some of that pigeon's blood, too," he continued in the same loud, ripping voice, addressing the waiter, who understood his desire only after he had looked in the direction of the long-nailed finger which unceremoniously pointed at the Englishman's glass. For some reason or other, Segur mentioned Ruby Rose, the lady who painted flowers on her breast, and the conversation took on a less insulting character. Meanwhile, the big Englishman suddenly made up his mind, got up on a chair, stepped from there onto the windowsill, and stretched up till he reached that coveted corner of the frame where rested a compact furry moth, which he deftly slipped into a pillbox. "Rather like Wolverman's white horse," said Ferdinand, in regard to something he was discussing with Segur.
"Tu es très épique ce matin," remarked the latter. Soon they both left to telephone. Ferdinand was particularly fond of long-distance calls, and particularly good at endowing them, no matter what the distance, with a friendly warmth when it was necessary, as, for instance, now, to make sure of free lodgings. From afar came the sounds of music, a trumpet, a zither. Nina and I set out to wander again. The circus, on its way to Fialta, had apparently sent out runners. An advertising pageant was trampling by, but we did not catch its head, as it had turned uphill into a side alley. The gilded back of some carriage was receding, a man in a burnoose led a camel, a file of four mediocre Indians carried placards on poles, and behind them, by special permission, a tourist's small son in a sailor suit sat reverently on a tiny pony. We wandered by a café where the tables were now almost dry but still empty. The waiter was examining, I hope he adopted it later, a horrible foundling. The absurd inkstand affair, stowed by Ferdinand on the banisters in passing. At the next corner we were attracted by an old stone stairway, and we climbed up, and I kept looking at the sharp angle of Nina's step as she ascended, raising her skirt, its narrowness requiring the same gesture as formerly length had done. She diffused a familiar warmth, and going up beside her, I recalled the last time we had come together. It had been in a Paris house, with many people around, and my dear friend Jules Darboux, wishing to do me a refined aesthetic favor, had touched my sleeve and said, "I want you to meet," and led me to Nina, who sat in the corner of a couch, her body folded Z-wise, with an ashtray at her heel, and she took a long turquoise cigarette holder from her lips and joyfully, slowly exclaimed, "Well, of all people!" And then all evening my heart felt like breaking as I passed from group to group with a sticky glass in my fist, now and then looking at her from a distance. She did not look, and listened to scraps of conversation, and overheard one man saying to another, "Funny how they all smell alike, burnt leaf through whatever perfume they use, those angular, dark-haired girls." And as it often happens, a trivial remark, related to some unknown topic, coiled and clung to one's own intimate recollection, a parasite of its sadness. At the top of the steps, we found ourselves on a rough kind of terrace. From here, one could see the delicate outline of the dove-colored Mount St. George with a cluster of bone-white flecks, some hamlet on one of its slopes. The smoke of an indiscernible train undulated along its rounded base and suddenly disappeared. Still lower, above the jumble of roofs, one could perceive a solitary cypress, resembling the moist, twirled black tip of a watercolor brush. To the right, one caught a glimpse of the sea, which was gray with silver wrinkles. At our feet lay a rusty old key, and on the wall of the half-ruined house adjoining the terrace, the ends of some wire still remained hanging. I reflected that formerly there had been life here. A family had enjoyed the coolness at nightfall. Clumsy children had colored pictures by the light of a lamp. We lingered there as if listening to something. Nina, who stood on higher ground, put a hand on my shoulder and smiled, and carefully, so as not to crumple her smile, kissed me. With an unbearable force, I relived, or so it now seems to me, all that had ever been between us, beginning with a similar kiss. And I said, substituting for our cheap, formal thou, that strangely full and expressive you, to which the circumnavigator enriched all around returns. Look here. What if I love you? Nina glanced at me. I repeated those words. I wanted to add, but something like a bat passed swiftly across her face, a quick, queer, almost ugly expression, and she, who would utter coarse words with perfect simplicity, became embarrassed. I also felt awkward. Never mind, I was only joking, I hastened to say, lightly encircling her waist. From somewhere a firm bouquet of small, dark, unselfishly smelling violets appeared in her hands, and before she'd returned to her husband and car, we stood for a little while longer by the stone parapet, and our romance was even more hopeless than it had ever been. But the stone was as warm as flesh, and suddenly I understood something I had been seeing without understanding. Why a piece of tin foil had sparkled so on the pavement, why the gleam of a glass had trembled on a tablecloth, why the sea was a shimmer. Somehow by imperceptible degrees the white sky above Fialta had got saturated with sunshine, and now it was sun-pervaded throughout. And this brimming white radiance grew broader and broader. All dissolved in it, all vanished, all passed. And I stood on the station platform of Mlech with a freshly bought newspaper, which told me that the yellow car I had seen under the plane trees had suffered a crash beyond Fialta, having run at full speed into the truck of a traveling circus entering the town, a crash from which Ferdinand and his friend, those invulnerable rogues, those salamanders of fate, those basilisks of good fortune, had escaped with local and temporary injury to their scales, while Nina, in spite of her long-standing, faithful imitation of them, had turned out, after all, to be mortal.